Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
A few nights ago, I woke up and had a nightmare. I remember I leapt out of bed and Laura reported later that morning telling me that I was saying, "It's okay. It's okay, Laura. You're okay." I think she said something like, "Go back to bed." But I couldn't. You know, my heart was pounding. The adrenaline was going. Obviously, everything was fine, but I was primed and ready to fight whatever monster or terrorist or whoever it was that's breaking into my suburban home. But then I came to my senses and realized, oh, never mind, everything is A-okay. And yet I couldn't go back to sleep. You know, my nerves were all wrangled and I just couldn't. So I went out to the living room to, you know, get a nice glass of milk and calm myself down. And I think it was like 1 or 2 in the morning. So I decided to go on the internet and just catch up on news a little bit, even though I know that's a terrible thing. Don't look at blue light before you're trying to go to sleep. But I'm only human, you know. And I got to be aware of stories and other things that are happening in the world to share with you here on the Council of Trent podcast. What I wanted to talk about today were two articles I read a few nights ago during my sleepless venture at 2 in the morning that surprisingly connect with one another, though you wouldn't think so at first. Before I get to that, though, I want to give a big shout out and thanks to our subscribers at TrenthornPodcast.com. You make this podcast possible. Without you, we could not do this. Everything here at Catholic Answers has to be self-funded. The magazine is supported by subscribers. The radio has its pledge drive. And the Council of Trent podcast has you. And to thank you for your support, you get access to all kinds of great bonus content. Next week, I'll be releasing the second episode in my Trent Tracks series, over an hour-long, in-depth look at LGBT issues from a Catholic perspective. So you're not going to want to miss that. Those Trent Tracks are available from purchase, but they're also free if you are a silver level subscriber to the Council of Trent podcast. But another way you can support the podcast is by leaving a review at Google Play or iTunes. That helps people know about the podcast and come and check it out. So here's what I wanted to talk about. I was reading an article. I thought it was talking about a shooting that had taken place recently, but it was actually a discussion of a shooting at a yoga studio in Tallahassee, Florida, back last November. Though it's the article's from the Washington Post, but I've run out of my free Post articles. Thankfully, some of our listeners have emailed to me to give us ways to be able to access some of these online news articles. And so I'm grateful for the access. Some people have special venue or university access to these resources. And so I'm grateful for that. I'll be looking into that to be able to read the Times, the Post, Wall Street Journal, all these other kinds of resources to share the news with you. So this article in Washington Post was published about a week ago. And it was reprinted here on a New Zealand website, actually. That's one way I've gotten around this. I search for keywords for the webs. If there's an article on a newspaper and it's behind a paywall, sometimes it's reposted on other websites. The newspaper lets foreign outlets publish it, for example. How the article says, how a male supremacist became so angry he opened fire at a yoga studio. The article starts this way. The first thing Kate Pearson did after unlocking the yoga studio that November afternoon was set the mood, plugging in the soothing waterfall, selecting a cheery lemongrass oil for the scent diffuser. The thermostat was turned up to 36 degrees Celsius for the 5:30 p.m. class. I'm going to hazard a guess. That's around, like, I don't know, 90 degrees maybe. She says that there were mostly women, but the men who went there for the class were at ease with the light and love mission of the place. But the man who walked in about 5:15 p.m. that Friday was different. Pearson was still alone in the lobby when he entered, a big guy whose maroon Florida State University t-shirt was stretched over a paunchy belly, the wrapper still on the yoga mat under his arm. A black Planet Fitness bag was strapped across his chest. Inside, she would learn soon, was a Glock 9mm pistol. So later on, after the class started, Pearson took out his gun and fired, I think, at 6 people, killing 2. One of the male students in the class actually hit him with a vacuum cleaner and a broom, and that managed to stop him after the events there began to transpire. The article says, Byerly was an avowed hater of women. A man who repeatedly grabbed women in real life and fantasized about raping and killing them in the horrific collection of lyrics, poetry, and novels he began writing as a teenager. His interactions with the opposite sex had gotten him fired from teaching jobs, booted from the army, and hauled before the principal of his high school. He traced his fury at women, quote, "just beneath their blushing lashes and their innocent smiles lies the most rancid and putrid, sickening essences." To the girls who both aroused and frustrated him in eighth grade. It is a kind of hatred that experts in extremism warn is becoming more common and more dangerous, providing what amounts to a new feeder network for white supremacy and neo-Nazi groups. This is not a lone incident. This is now being called male supremacy. It's a kind of, it's a weird thing because you think of white supremacists, for example, they believe that other minorities are subhuman or less than them, and they have a revulsion and an antagonism towards members of minority communities. Male supremacists are odd because they have that same revulsion towards women, but also a seemingly insatiable attraction to them. They desire sexual gratification from women, and when they can't receive that, they blame the women for what they've done. And there's a larger online community of these individuals. So what I want to do in the podcast today is I want to talk about this community. They're called incels. And then as we get close to the end of the podcast, I want to reference another article that I was reading online when I was, you know, recovering from my nightmare. It was an article. It's about a dispute between National Review's David French, one of my favorite authors, and Sohrab Armani, who published an essay in First Things talking about what do we do as a religion that's increasingly persecuted? What do we do to stand up for what we believe in? And as I promised, these two issues do connect. So before we get to French and Armani, I think it's Armani, Amari, sorry, Sohrab Amari, not Armani, not the suit collection. Sohrab Armani and David French. Before I get to that, I want to talk about these incels, because there's a pattern here. There's a large, I don't know if it's large, but more than I'm comfortable with, community of individuals, men online, called incels. The name stands for involuntary celibates. Now, of course, what's funny is whenever people talk about this, they get it wrong. Celibate just means you're not married. Many of these guys do want to get married, but it also seems most of them just want to have sex and want to hook up, and they want to emulate men that they think can casually hook up with women. So they're not celibate, they're continent, in the sense that they are not engaging in sexual activities. So maybe they could be incons, but then incontinence just means you can't go to the bathroom. So I am worried about making fun of these people a little bit too much because some of them are prone to violence. And this is an isolated incident. On April 23rd, 2018, so just, you know, 6 months before Byerly's attack on the yoga studio in Tallahassee, Manassian, I think his name was Scott Manassian. See, this is why I got to have more detailed notes here. Manassian shooting. This was a shooting in Toronto, and the suspect was. Just start with the name here, so that I can share this with people. Wikipedia, Alec Manassian. So Alec Manassian, April 23rd, 2018, he ran a truck across a van across a bunch of pedestrians in Toronto, killing 10 and injuring 16. Though what's scary about it is he left this Facebook message, this status, before he committed this violent attack. "Private Recruit Manassian, Infantry 10, wishing to speak to Sergeant 4chan, please." And then he gives a made-up serial number. "The incel rebellion has already begun. We will overthrow all the Chads and Stacys. All hail the Supreme Gentleman, Elliot Roger." And what's creepy about that, well, for a number of reasons, according to incels, there are a few group of hyper-attractive men called the Chads who hog all of the ladies and get all of the sexual attention. And so there's two kinds of women out there. There are the Stacys, who are the super attractive women who won't pay the incels any attention whatsoever and just want the Chads, and the Beckys, who are the not very attractive women who still want the Chads and don't want the incels. You can see there's a strange analytical techno misogyny among these people's writings. On one of the incel websites I visited, one of the guys, he writes this of the Beckys. So remember, Stacys are the really, really attractive ones who want the Chads. The Beckys are the other girls who want the Chads as well. "Beckys are a variant of femoids, rather than women, directly subordinate to Stacys in terms of looks and social status. Despite their lower position on the social totem pole, they will nonetheless pursue the top 20% of males while ignoring their looks matches. This sexual jockeying often puts them at odds with both each other as well as with Stacey's. So these are guys who just sit around. And there is an interesting video on, I found a video actually, it's on Vice, Vice News, talking about what it's like to be one of these incels. And so before I play that, though, I need to talk about Elliot Rodger. This is a guy who really, his actions have prompted incels to become more dangerous online and to motivate them to double down on their hate and their misogyny and, frankly, their disorder. I think 9 times out of 10, most of these guys have some kind of mental illness, probably clinical depression, social anxiety disorder. The video I'll play from the Vice interview, the guy straight up admits it. So Elliot Rodger went on a shooting spree in May 23rd, 2014. So around every May 23rd or so. That's why I think they wrote this article a little bit after May about the incels. Incels kind of hail this guy as a hero. His plan was to go and kill as many members of a sorority at UC Santa Barbara as he could because he was mad about women rejecting him. And he posted this manifesto online and he left a final super uber creepy video message about it. So I'll play that. And I'm not just dwelling on the incels because I think it's morbid and awful, which it is. There's a larger truth here when it comes to engaging our world and views of sexuality that we have to talk about, because I believe the truth and goodness of what the church teaches, what the gospel teaches about who we are as human beings and who we are as sexual beings provides good news. And our culture, that I believe a lot of these incels, they are the byproduct of a broken culture fostered by the sexual revolution. That's a point David French makes. I'm going to read from his article here in a bit. But this is Elliot Rodger, you know, killed 6 people, injured several others at UC Santa Barbara, went on the shooting spree. This is his last video message before he went into it. It really gets you into the mindset of what these incels are like.
Hi, Elliot Rodger here. Well, this is my last video. It all has to come to this. Tomorrow is the day of retribution. The day in which I will have my revenge against humanity, against all of you. For the last 8 years of my life, ever since I've hit puberty, I've been forced to endure an existence of loneliness, rejection, and unfulfilled desires, all because girls have never been attracted to me. Girls gave their affection and sex and love to other men, but never to me. I'm 22 years old and I'm still a virgin. I've never even kissed a girl. I've been through college for 2.5 years, more than that actually, and I'm still a virgin. That has been very torturous. College is the time when everyone experiences those things such as sex and fun and pleasure. But in those years, I've had to rot in loneliness.
And then it goes on like that for another 5 minutes or so and becomes more and more grim as he brags about what he's going to do, basically. So, all right, what are some things we can take away from this? Christine Emba in the Washington Post actually makes a fairly decent point. This is what she writes. She talks about a book called Man Out, Men on the Sidelines of American Life by Andrew Yarrow. And so she says, Yarrow describes millennial men as the new lost boys. As many as 1 in 3 American 18 to 34-year-old men are unemployed, living at home, or at or near the poverty line due to a confluence of factors ranging from economic shifts to student debt. Women are surging ahead, out-enrolling men in colleges and universities. A new uncertainty about their place in the world is leading men to spiking levels of anxiety and depression. It's easy to conclude that the incel should just log off, look up, and get outside more. In the past, they might have been forced to do so. But human connection in the real world has become rarer and often feels more difficult than it used to be. Smartphones and gaming are replacing face-to-face interactions, the sort that might force one to confront one's social difficulties or develop a better understanding of the lives of others. free-floating pornography, persistently sexualized media, and ubiquitous swipe-on-site dating apps have made sexual relationships, or at least sex, seem like something everyone is having without us, and that we might be failing by not having enough of. So, and we'll talk about what people will say is like, oh, well, what is the solution to this? When you listen to Rogers, when you listen to these incels, they do not crave pleasure as such. You know, Rogers says, I want sex, I want pleasure, I want fun. But deep down, that isn't what they want. Deep down, they want genuine human, they want validation and they want meaning. One of my favorite works of psychotherapy or psychology is Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. Frankl was a survivor in the Nazi concentration camps, and he saw that the people who were most likely to survive being in the camps were the people who had found meaning in this experience, seeing there's a point for me to be here and there's a reason for me to make my way through this. And so Frankl pioneered a kind of psychotherapy he called logos therapy, which seeks to help people overcome psychological problems by finding meaning in their life. So these guys have an absence of sexual relations. That's not the problem. Some people think it is, and I'll address that here in a moment. But as we live in a culture today where people have a total, utter absence of meaning, or the one thing that provides meaning is social validation from others, getting likes on your tweets, getting shares, retweets, views, a high like ratio on your YouTube videos, accolades and comments under user forums on Reddit. And if you don't have that, then you don't have meaning. So this is an interview from a year ago, August 2018, a Vice News piece on incels. So let's play a little bit of that so you can hear another member of this community who doesn't espouse violence, but still has very self-destructive habits.
What is an incel?
It's involuntarily celibate. It's just something you are. You know, volcel is voluntarily celibate. Incel is involuntarily celibate, meaning you've tried many times and failed. And then there's mental cells, which probably best fits me, someone who can't form a relationship because of mental blockage.
What have you been diagnosed as?
Agoraphobia, obsessive compulsive disorder, social anxiety, social paranoia. That's not even a thing.
Joey is 23 years old. He doesn't have a job. He's not in school. On a given day, he may not get up from his chair, where he sits sometimes for 2 days straight, smoking cigarettes and running chat rooms.
Honestly, I feel more real here, sitting in front of the computer. When I go outside, I almost depersonalize a little bit and feel like I'm playing a video game.
So there it is right there. I think that is a core of a problem we're facing among lots of people today, is this kind of isolation, this alienation, that you lose the essence of what it means to be human, that, you know, as Aristotle said, man is a social animal. And so at first it seems tempting. You can be in a chat room and have 9 windows up of other guys you can talk to who share these views, but then it becomes a destructive echo chamber. And this is happening to a lot of people, not just the incels, but you go on the internet and you form a bubble of individuals, or what's called an echo chamber, who reinforce your views. And it's sad because sometimes I go out and I try to seek out other people who have different views than me, always unfortunately so in comment sections on other blogs. And I try to have, you know, hey, I want to have an honest discussion here. And immediately the knives come out because people aren't used to engaging someone who disagrees with them. They've just been in their echo chamber. And as Catholics, we can do that as well. That's why here on the podcast, I like to bring on people who disagree. I mean, it's easy, especially on Catholic or Christian podcasts or radio shows. You can have people who agree with one another and they can talk about what they agree on. And that's easy. And you get a kind of entertainment from hearing that because you're never challenged. But then it's different. And you can sometimes play devil's advocate in these situations. Like, oh, well, they'll say this. But you never defend it as well as the person really believes it. That's why when I have someone like my friend Randall, or I've got other guests lined up here over the next few months, we're not going to have those neat and tidy conversations. We're not going to have every thread's going to be wrapped up. Because these are important issues to discuss if people disagree with you. But the point is, even if we vigorously disagree, there are other apologists out there for Protestantism or atheism. I disagree with them, sometimes vigorously, but I can still have civility. And that's something that we're losing. So I think one way to help, in order to spread the gospel to people in the world today, we should combine what we know from Revelation that is good for the soul, things like virtue, you know, getting back to virtue, but also things we've learned from science, like understanding that the human being is not a soul trapped in a body. We are a union of body and soul. When something's wrong with our body, it can affect our soul. It can affect our mind. Many of these individuals who are prone to violence or into these self-destructive behaviors very clearly have some kind of mental illness. I've had personal close experience with mental illness. And the thing is, you can't just get somebody to snap out of it. It's one thing, you know, if you have a friend, if you have a relative, a loved one, who, let's say they have cancer or leukemia, and they vomit on your floor. That's, you know, it's never great to clean up vomit. But you don't get mad at them because, you know, they're sick. It's not their fault. It's you know, an inconvenience, but you don't get mad at them. But if you have a family member with a mental illness who yells and screams at you and says horrible, mean things to you, you want to get mad at them without saying, oh, well, they have that. That isn't entirely their fault either. There may be some culpability there, but it's greatly diminished. And you can't say, well, just snap out of it. It's like telling somebody with cancer, just snap out of it. Well, no, for many cases, these people have hormonal and chemical imbalances in the brain that have to be adjusted. Now I don't think that pills and chemicals are the way to fix everything. I also believe, for example, that cognitive or talk therapy to help you think through problems is also something that's greatly neglected nowadays. But I don't think that sex is just the answer. So, for example, on Joe Rogan's podcast, he had a clip that went up a few weeks ago. He was talking to Greg Fitzsimmons, and they talked about the incels. And they made the point, well, what about prostitution? So let me play that clip.
And that's why there's an argument for legalized prostitution, because there are men that just because of deformities or whatever reason, or maybe they're even neurotic to where they can't hit on a woman. And so there should be a place where a woman can knowingly and confidently and safely be a prostitute.
Yes. Yes. It should be your option. The problem is we equate prostitution with two things that are horrible: sexual abuse and sex slavery, sex trafficking. We equate prostitution with those things. That's why, like, when Robert Kraft got
Rogan goes on kind of a tangent about Robert Kraft and what happened there. Funny, though, when it comes to prostitution, if you go back to St. Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages, he actually argued for the legalization of prostitution, or harlotry, as it would be called there. That might have surprised you. The reason for that is Thomas held the view that Augustine held as well, is that government can't legislate everything. The government can't legislate all morality, because if it did that, that might be an affront to the common good. So imagine, for example, it was a crime to break a promise to a friend. You promised to help a friend move on Saturday, and you didn't show up because, you know, you canceled, said, hey, you know, I'm sorry, the kids, you know, I can't do that. What if he could report you to the police and say, hey, he broke a promise. All right, you got to go down to court. If every single saying hurtful things about other people, you know, or whatever it may be, if every single immoral thing was made illegal, then the society would actually be worse off. So Catholic legal theory, natural law theory, talks about the principle of toleration of some vices, but not all vices. Thomas goes on to say, talking about how the state can literally execute heretics, for example, if the state also uses the death penalty against people who commit lesser crimes, like forgers, people who forge money. That's not an argument for the death penalty today, because the state doesn't execute people just for printing counterfeit money. Well, at least the United States doesn't do that. So Thomas put it this way, though. He said, accordingly, in human government also, those who are in authority rightly tolerate certain evils, lest certain goods be lost or certain evils be incurred. Thus, Augustine says, quoting St. Augustine, if you do away with harlots, the world will be convulsed with lust. So the argument here is that, well, we need legalized prostitution because otherwise the world will turn into a kind of rapey nightmare. But I would say we are not beholden to that mode of thinking today, because we can show from sociological data that there isn't more rape and more crime in areas where prostitution is illegal, because prostitution is only legal in very, very limited cases here in the United States. I think it's only really legal in Clark County outside of the city limits of Las Vegas. You have the infamous Bunny Ranch, for example. And yet we can, you know, it's not dependent on keeping that legal to reduce things like rape. And I would say that Rogan brings up the point, but I don't think he goes into it more clearly. It's not just that we conflate prostitution with sex trafficking and abuse. is that the two really go hand in hand together and they facilitate one another. Though I'll have to do another entire podcast on, you know, questions of prostitution, civil liberties, and things like that. Rather, I like the response that David French gave back, I think it was after the Manassian attack in Toronto. He wrote an article in National Review called "The Sexless Life When Sex is God," that the problem here is not, as I said earlier, finding people who want sex and giving them sex. That's not what will make them happy. Because in the end, Elliot Rodger, the incels, if they have to pay for prostitutes, they're still going to feel invalidated and less of a man than a Chad who just walks into the sorority house and everyone wants to have relations with him, I guess. No, I like French's approach. He says, "The sexual revolution didn't just disrupt existing social norms and existing theological ideas. It sought to replace them with a worldview that elevated sexual experience to quasi-religious status. Sex isn't just part of life. It is essential to fulfillment, a conservative response dedicated to, quote, reviving or adapting older ideas about the virtues of monogamy and chastity and permanence and the special respect owed to the celibate is, quote, not the natural response for a society like ours. So I'd suggest a modification. Celebration of monogamy and chastity should be the result of the intended much larger transformation. Put simply, one cannot locate his sense of transcendence in chastity or monogamy, but rather in the obedience to and reverence for a living God. The men of the incel movement are pursuing a God they can't have. They're in fact pursuing a God that will disappoint them, even if they obtain what they want the most. And so they do what sinful men have done throughout all of human history. They lash out at the objects of their desire. No woman should feel the least bit guilty for not desiring any man, no matter how many movies or television shows teach them that the nerd is the true prize and the lonely man is the best catch. Instead, it is the responsibility of the lonely man to find meaning apart from women. And that meaning happens to be found in a resurrected Christ who, unlike any other false god, can be found by any person who seeks his face." So French has talked a lot about in his writings about how, as Christians, we live in a very post-Christian culture, and we have to get people to see that this culture is empty and cannot ultimately satisfy them, and that also we can't satisfy people by just jerry-rigging the political order so that it satisfies everyone's needs as they want. Ultimately, the state isn't equipped to do that. The state isn't equipped to give us salvation. Only God can do that through the church that he's established or through the gospel he's given us. French is an evangelical. He's not Catholic, but he sympathizes with many Catholic views about restoring culture, and I'm one of French's faithful Catholic fans. So a few weeks ago, Sarab Amari wrote an article in First Things called "Against David Frenchism," which I always think it's weird when you pick an idea and you just pin it on somebody like that. It's very, even people who agree with Amari say that it's not the best named thing. And so Amari is arguing essentially for something called Catholic integralism. It's the view that, look, we have to stop playing nice with the liberal culture, with the secular humanist culture. We have to stop playing nice with them. We shouldn't just say, oh, everyone should be free to live their life how they want within the boundaries of the common good. And we should instead be working towards reestablishing a Catholic state so that the public order is reordered to the public good. So this is how he puts it in his First Things article. It isn't easy to critique the persona of someone as nice as French. Then again, it is in part that earnest and insistently polite quality of his that I find unsuitable to the depth of the present crisis facing religious conservatives, which is why I recently quipped on Twitter that there is no polite David Frenchian third way around the cultural civil war. What prompted my ire was a Facebook ad for a children's drag queen reading hour at a public library. I added, the only way is through. That is to say, to fight the culture war with the aim of defeating the enemy and enjoying the spoils in the form of a public square reordered to the common good and ultimately the highest good. French prefers a different Christian strategy, and his guileless public mean and strategic preferences bespeak a particular political theology. He says the talk of politics as war and enmity is thoroughly alien to French, who believes the institutions of a technocratic market society are neutral zones. So the idea here is what Amari is saying is, look, forget about trying to persuade people to be Catholic or to be virtuous or to be Christian. Instead, Christians should band together and we should make the state promote the Catholic good. Instead of trying to persuade people, for example, not to have a children's drag queen reading at the public library, we should be running the state and we should say, no, there are no public drag queen readings. This is the law. That's the end of it because this is contrary to the common good of society. End of debate. And I know a fair amount of people will read Amari's post and be like, yeah, we should be doing this. I'm tired of just kowtowing these people. We need to fight back. We need to take our world back, take our country back. And when I hear this, I want to say in response, how do you plan on doing that? And the response always is very vague. Because at the end of the day, we live in a pluralistic society. Even Rod Dreher makes a very good point about this. When you can't even get a majority of Catholics to agree that same-sex marriage is wrong, how are you going to get a majority of our culture to do that? How are you going to create a Catholic state that reorders the public good on things like marriage when even the majority of people in the church haven't, and I'm talking everybody, even the people that go to Mass on Christmas and Easter only, haven't bought into that? We need a cultural renewal first. And that makes sense. And that when we do that, that doesn't mean that we ignore the courts. In French's reply to Amari, he makes the case, I'm not just saying, oh, preach love and kindness. French is a lawyer, and he has gone to bat for civil liberties cases for Christians, arguing and getting non-Christian judges to see things from a liberal perspective that, well, we should allow people to have liberty to practice their religion without having their consciences violated. French appeals to other things like that as well. I want to read then, as we're coming to the end of our time together, the conclusion of French's reply to Amari, because I think it's very poignant and fitting to how we as Christians, we understand that we are at war, so to speak, but we are not at war with other people. That's the problem, I think, with Amari's approach. In 2 Corinthians 10:3-5, St. Paul says, we fight powers, we fight demonic powers, and we fight with weapons that are capable of destroying fortresses, but we don't destroy people. He says, we destroy arguments, taking every thought captive to Christ. So we don't fight people, we fight demonic powers, and we fight the bad ideas those demonic powers use to ensnare people who are made in the image and likeness of God. So this is how French ends his reply to Amari on this question. I've gone on too long, but let me close with an important point of agreement with Amari. He says, I don't see politics as war and enmity. And he's right about that much. I do not see politics as war. And while enmity exists, I seek to lessen it, not fan the flames. But it was not always so. Many years ago, before I deployed to an actual war, I gave a speech at a conservative gathering in which I actually said these words. I believe the two greatest threats to the United States are university leftists at home and jihadists abroad. Looking back, I'm ashamed I said it. It was fundamentally wrong, as I quickly learned during my deployment. In the course of almost a year in Dialia Province, Iraq, I saw the most dreadful things, sights that haunt me today. Eastern Dialia under Al-Qaeda's thumb was one of the deadliest places on earth. And as much as I disagree with university radicals, I lived a happy life in law school in Deep Blue, Cambridge, Massachusetts. My son was born in Deep Blue, Ithaca, New York. I served as president of FIRE, a Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, while living comfortably on the outskirts of Philadelphia's so-called gayborhood. My political opponents are my fellow citizens. When I wore the uniform of my country, I was willing to die for them. Why would I think I'm at war with them now? I disagree with the left and much of the populist right vigorously. If and when any of my political opponents seeks to undermine our fundamental freedoms, I'll be there to pick a legal, political, and cultural fight with them. I won't yield. I won't stop. I won't be weak. But I also won't turn my back on the truths of Scripture. I won't stop seeking justice, loving mercy, and walking humbly. There is no political emergency that justifies abandoning classical liberalism. And there will never be a temporal emergency that justifies rejecting the eternal truth. So those are words I agree with, that we have to go and renew our culture. We have to fight, but don't mistake the enemy for someone who has been brainwashed by him. So I hope you'll take lessons from this podcast, from my books and the writings of other good people like David French, other thoughtful thinkers, to go out and spread the gospel to a world that desperately needs it. You all have been wonderful. Thanks for your support. Be sure to leave a review at iTunes and check out TrentHornPodcast.com. Have a blessed day, everybody.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.